In this June 2022 Australian Catholic Historical Society podcast, the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Notre Dame, Australia, Professor Francis Campbell, speaks about a place for faith in the public square. Professor Campbell is introduced by ACHS President Dr. John Carmody.
Now today we have a truly remarkable speaker. The Sydney Morning Herald gets the credit, but my opportunism comes second, because I saw an article about someone having lunch with Francis, and I thought, there's someone whom I should have for our speakers program for the next year. And so I'm very pleased to welcome Professor Francis Campbell, the Vice-Chancellor of Notre Dame University, who spends half his time in the West and half his time in the East. He's very scrupulous, he told me, but I won't even bother to tell you the travails he had when he said he was responsible for partition, introducing partition to Australia, a very Irish joke, when he was crossing the country and trying to negotiate closed national borders as well as international borders. But Francis is, and I said, I didn't quite know whether I'd recognise him or not, because he's not only a vice-chancellor, but he's also got a background as a diplomat, and they dress very differently and they behave very differently. So he has an extraordinary curriculum vitae, which I will summarise because it makes his topic today very, very pertinent, very relevant, coming out of great experience as well as anything else. He was born on the border of Ulster and the Irish Federal Republic. He went to Queen's University in Belfast, and it's a pretty Protestant place. But Francis went into the British diplomatic service, so as a result he refuses to make a distinction about whether he's a Briton or an Irishman. He can be both, he tells me, which I think is a juggling act that is worth noting and commending. But he was ambassador to the Vatican for 5 years or thereabouts, and then he was also a senior policy advisor to Tony Blair. Now, if anyone knows about the challenges of negotiating faith in the public square, Francis does. So we're really looking forward to hearing what you have to say, Francis. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Jack, for those very warm words of introduction. And ladies and gentlemen, it's a delight to be with you. Now, I suppose I should come out with a few apologies in advance. And one is that the whole area of faith in the public square in Australia is still a learning journey for me, as indeed is my arrival into Australia and the last 2 years. And everybody keeps telling me, when I say to them that one of the things that you discover about Australia is the degree of internal tensions between the various states. There's no conception or comprehension outside as to how strong the state identities are within Australia and the, dare I say, healthy tension with the federal concept. And those much more well-versed in Australian constitutional and federal norms say, Francis, the last 2 years have been a learning experience for us as well, so don't judge it on the basis of COVID. But it's a delight to be with you today. It's a delight to be able to address this topic, to do so with a sort of historical backdrop, but also to do as well along some of the philosophical traditions that we're based on. And as Jack said, one of the things Jack did was to acknowledge country. And that is, again, something that, coming with an Irish background where identity and land is contested, perhaps there is something in that the Australian experience in a, dare I say, uncontroversial but highly symbolic way can actually hold out something to the Irish experience as we try to disaggregate, in my part of the world, aspects of different identities linked to territory and land. So, ladies and gentlemen, to attempt to open up the topic of a place for faith in the public square, I would like to do two things with you this afternoon. first to say something about the public square, the changing world, in particular the realities we face. Second, to address how faith interacts with that changing world and how it can form the wider culture and help to remain open and yet always sufficiently inclusive. It is not contested that we inhabit a changing world where faith is active and where it is indeed needed to provide a deeper meaning to what at times can be a very quick and instant world. In Australia, we face a strange contradiction, a public square that tips its hat to religious symbolism, but sometimes squashes any attempt to find inspiration from the spiritual, the divine. Our parliaments, for example, regularly pronounce the Lord's Prayer before commencing a sitting, and many of us swear oaths to the judiciary. We celebrate Christian holidays and commence the common era from the time of Christ. But we ridicule those who feel inspired by their faith and regularly rail against churches expressing their perspectives on legislation coming before Houses of Parliament. More than ever, Catholicism, despite being at the forefront of public policy debates in Australia for two centuries, now finds itself forming alliances across other faiths, Christian or non-Christian, in order to be heard. In the late 19th century, many of the then colonies were racked by sectarianism, and the Catholic Church competed with other Christian denominations, principally Anglicanism, to be heard. These groupings were the defining cultural entities in public life. Now we see a profound cultural realignment, where the great divide is amongst an increasing number of people who would prefer to see religious belief completely banished from public life, and people of faith who maintain that their beliefs can result in a range of critical benefits for community and society. At the heart of this battle, ladies and gentlemen, is the notion of pluralism, the diversity of perspective, belief, and even service delivery approaches, which should characterise a truly free society. As a society, we, especially in the West, perhaps, need to rediscover a healthy plurality, which can allow multiple identities to exist and flourish within government and the broader society, a place where faith can also navigate the secular world. We have to help society perhaps rediscover its capacity to deal with ever more complex worlds of difference, which it did successfully for many hundreds of years. That means helping societies deal with the question of what role faith plays or should play in the society. The choice increasingly can often come down to two options, to either a religious state or an excessively secular one. And often the West is seen as the advocate of the latter, or at least drifting, perhaps unconsciously, in that direction. But that choice, either religious, theocracy, or militant secular, is a false one because it does not allow for historical context and simply seeks to impose either a form of secular theocracy or a pure theocracy. History and philosophy show that there is no uniformity of view across the West about the place of faith in society. 1789 and the French Revolution and the emergence of an all-powerful and dominant government which consumes society is not the story of the UK, Ireland, or Australia, or at least it was not up to this point in our respective histories. Unpacking the differences between the Enlightenment traditions could help to provide a framework where contemporary citizens do not have to choose either or, but can be both. Showing that the Enlightenment of 1789 is not the same as that of 1776 can create a thriving space for faith in society without it becoming the basis for national identity. Societies increasingly struggle yet again to deal with the question of what role religion plays or does not play in our respective societies and how it assists or undermines cohesion. That is compounded by a growing diversity of religions and sometimes even questions about what constitutes a recognised religion and how to deal in a fair and equitable way with all religions, beliefs, and views. This is taking place at a time when levels of religious literacy seem to be at an all-time low. In our contemporary culture, there is an increasingly prominent voice which would suggest that the only way to deal with the growing religious complexity is through creating a more privatized form of religion, to push it out of the public sphere and into the private. This ideology would have society believe that competing absolutist claims by faiths should be rejected, but perhaps with one sole exception. That is the absolutist claim that militant secularism is somehow neutral and objective and should therefore be the norm or the foundation. Such an offer of a level playing field, one that claims to be neutral, fair, objective and free of bias, could well seduce policymakers and politicians as they try to navigate the complexity of our culture and society. Decision makers will naturally struggle to navigate the diversity that is now a feature of modern Western societies, including Australia. How do you build cohesive societies amidst such a growing diversity? Gone are the days of perhaps homogeneity, if it was ever thus, when cohesion in society could rely on a common grammar. The problem is, you can try to take faith out of the public square, but you can't take the public square out of faith. What do I mean by that? The 19th century French political philosopher Alexis de Tocqueville explained it as he thought about Europe, America, and the transition from an age of aristocracy to an age of equality. He understood that one's theological principles and commitments were the sources of all other principles. We hear sometimes that politics is downstream from culture. Our culture shapes and drives what we want to accomplish in the political sphere, the sphere of collective human action. The first syllable of culture is, of course, cult. All that we think of as culture springs from cult, or from what we worship. But to say we don't want God in the public square doesn't change the problem. It's just a different decision about our basic theological commitment. It advocates a theological position of not God. This theological commitment is just as potentially powerful, just as fundamental as putting God into public square debates. So whether we like it or not, our understanding of faith is there always in our politics. Supposed religious neutrality isn't really neutral, therefore. We need to acknowledge that because it has consequences. Saying we'll free ourselves from God in our politics is a religious claim just as much as any theocratic moral claim. For regulatory authorities faced with pluralism and diversity, however, it might seem easier to roll back diversity, in this case faith, from the public sphere, and to impose a one-size-fits-all approach, arguing that it is neutral, fair, value for money, and the list could go on. But if this is done with faith, what other differences could be rolled back? Furthermore, rolling back faith would raise another set of problems. The new norm, what would it be neutral from, and fair to whom? In such a new era, whose values would prevail? Ladies and gentlemen, these are live questions for our society, across the world, but in particular in the West, and they require an intellectual contribution from within the Christian tradition. But it is not just the government that could retreat from navigating a more complex world. Faith groups themselves could retreat from navigating the complexity, promoting the distinctiveness of their offer in education or health, so that they could just blend in. They could stop engaging intellectually. Pope Francis has cautioned against just blending in. Speaking in Rome in May 2014 to a group of Italian schoolteachers and students, he said, "Education cannot be neutral. It is either positive or negative. Either it enriches or it impoverishes. Either it enables a person to grow or it lessens, even corrupts them. The mission of schools is to develop a sense of truth of what is good and beautiful." In other words, simply blending in erodes the distinctiveness and the very raison d'etre for existence as a separate offering. Both approaches, blending in or rolling back faith, would be wrong, as they would greatly diminish a culturally rich and diverse society which allows our culture to flourish. So to situate faith in our culture, must we first determine what the culture is and what underpins it. More specifically, we need to determine what type of polity do we live in or want, and how does it relate to faith? Is our culture a secular one which only sees a private role for faith in the wider society? Is it something which is confined to Sunday morning? Is it an individual freedom to worship, but without a collective dimension which is allowed to manifest itself in society? Will it be a world in which the government emerges with a monopoly on service provision and education, health, at the expense of wider society? Will it be a world where faith providers can perhaps deliver a service, but will not be able to call on official funds to do so? Or is our world one which will be comfortable with a multiple number of service providers, with the government regulating the space to sustain acceptable standards in service delivery and content? In such a world, ladies and gentlemen, regulator and service provider must find ways to cooperate, respecting the proper role and remit of the other. To date, the latter model most resembles our society here in Australia, and it is a system which it shares with the UK and Ireland. But there is no guarantee that such a model will always prevail. Choices and priorities will always be looked at afresh, and sometimes what can appear as a rather dry technical matter can have far-reaching consequences for society, the role of the individual in that society, the ability of organisations to engage and participate, and the very nature of government authority and control itself. But what guides our choices in society? Ladies and gentlemen, there are competing views about the future of our society. Much of it revolves around the place of faith. For example, in education, it is asked, why do taxpayers fund faith-based schools? Or why do we have hospitals with a religious ethos? All relevant and topical questions. But often such questions can be explored in a rather polemical manner, rather than approached with a depth and understanding of why things are as they are. So what are the theoretical underpinnings of our faith-based systems? What is the all-important historical context or philosophical tradition? It is thought that many nations, including many Western states, would not tolerate non-government providers or faith-based providers delivering essential services such as health or education on their behalf. One can think of the French Republic, for instance, which has quite a strict separation of church and state going back to 1789, and with subsequent laws strengthening the separation, most notably in 1905. But even in France, with a clear separation of church and state, cooperation exists between church and state in the fields of health and education. The history and tradition of Australia, the UK, and Ireland, though at one stage Ireland could have gone down the route of 1789, and perhaps as its republic evolves, it might still yet, is not that of 1789 and the French Revolution and the emergence of an all-powerful and dominant government which encroaches on society. The Australian and UK approach, at least up to now, was achieved more through evolution than revolution, and one which accords faith a role, not a privatised role in society. Ireland's republican tradition, at least until recently, was not modelled on that of France, especially when looking at the role of faith in the public arena. Because the Enlightenment tradition, ladies and gentlemen, that we often talk about, is not a single Enlightenment tradition. The Enlightenment of 1789 is not the same as that of 1776. Confusing the two can create difficulties in policy choices. The continental European and North American Enlightenments differ most sharply when it comes to faith and its place in the society. Professor Gertrude Himmelfarb describes the French Enlightenment as one where reason was not just pitted against religion, defined in opposition to religion, it was granted the same absolute dogmatic status as a religion. The French Revolution was more of a belated reformation, not fought in the name of a different interpretation of religion, but for a different form of authority, a rather narrower defined concept of reason. The Enlightenment in the English-speaking world did not accord reason that preeminence, and religion was not the paramount enemy. As a result, the English-speaking world had an Enlightenment which was more compatible with a large spectrum of belief and disbelief. The effect on faith has been summed up as a continental Enlightenment, which was about freedom from faith, to an American Enlightenment, which was about a freedom for faith. The policy choices we make will tell us something about the society we want to build and what role for government we accept within that society and its attitude to difference and the very right to be different. History has shown us numerous examples of how impossible it is to divorce a culture from its past. How faith communities, ladies and gentlemen, are treated can often be a litmus test for broader freedoms within the society and the place of the individual vis-a-vis the government. One can think of revolutionary France or the creation of the Soviet Union. Critiques by faith communities can help to reinforce democratic processes in liberal nations by ensuring alternative perspectives are heard and, crucially, that groupthink is avoided. So a faith perspective not just helps the government through the provision of services, but helps to ensure the very plurality that helps to keep the public space liberal. What does that mean? It means open to challenge. Without challenge, democratic nations run the risk of becoming illiberal and fostering a culture of uniformity, which can be unhealthy for the future of democracy itself. Western democracies, including in Australia, need debate and vibrant differences to remain alive and to achieve constant renewal. It is their very oxygen. So a pluralist approach on the part of the public policy allows for a variety of voices and providers rather than a singularity of approach. A plural space will often be open to greater participation by religious groups and other organisations and avoid authoritarian tendencies. A truly pluralist society will often be characterised by a lighter form of government, often acting as a regulator, but open to a variety of providers, meeting acceptable standards and contributing to a wider flourishing within society. This belief in pluralism is not alien to the Catholic tradition. It is central to it. It was enshrined in the Second Vatican Council when it said, "It is the task of the state to see to it that all citizens can come to a suitable share in culture and are properly prepared to exercise their civic duties and rights." In this meaning, ladies and gentlemen, pluralism is not just tolerance, but exchange and interest in the other. It is not relativism, but respecting distinctiveness. This definition of pluralism would allow, even encourage, groups to participate and engage in the society as individuals or through collective organisations, and would see them as contributing to the common good. But at the other extreme, pluralism is not anarchy. A pluralist society is aiming to do just what it says, build or administer a society which will be plural. Its goal is a society by plural means, and that will mean regulation and minimum standards. The history of humanity could be said to be about navigating or setting those minimum standards and ensuring a balanced equilibrium between individuals, communities and governments or their historical precedents. It is highly unlikely that the boundaries between government and communities and individuals will ever definitively be settled. They are always likely to be blurred, and that is often the challenge of living in community, balancing interests, rights and obligations. Pluralism helps the very cohesion in a society that allows them to function. Jürgen Habermas and Doyen of the Frankfurt School said, "It remains the case that liberal societal structures are dependent on the solidarity of their citizens. And if the secularisation of society goes off the rails, the sources of this solidarity may dry up altogether. that could well slacken the democratic bond and exhaust the kind of solidarity that democratic government needs but can never impose simply by law. This would lead to the transformation of the citizens of prosperous and peaceful liberal societies into isolated nomads acting from their own self-interest, persons who use their subjective rights only as weapons against each other. End of quote. But how to avoid a drying up of solidarity, which serves to provide the glue of consensus and the basics which allow our societies to exist and function? Some might think that we can roll back that which is distinctive and come to rely on regulation as a means of providing much-needed cohesion and solidarity in society. But is that enough to build community or to keep our societies together and functioning? We can see from the world of economics that regulation is not enough. Professor Philip Booth said recently, "Regardless of how we regulate economic activity, there is no substitute for resourceful, ethical people in all sectors of the economy. In place of virtue, we have seen an expansion of regulation. A society that is held together just by compliance to rules is inherently fragile, open to further abuses which will be met by a further expansion of regulation. This cannot be enough. Regulation won't help us with integration or the socialization of society. It's not enough to build societies or to keep them together." Joseph Ratzinger provides a framework beyond regulation, and one which partly came from his dialogue in the early years of this millennium with Jürgen Habermas. He wrote, "Only in conditions of healthy secularity can a society be constructed in which diverse traditions, cultures, and religions peacefully coexist." He said, "To totally separate public life from all valuing of traditions means to embark on a closed, dead-end path." His healthy secularism, ladies and gentlemen, is a definition of pluralism and a rejection of an approach based on reductionist regulations. So what does all this mean in our cultural and political context today? What role should faith play in our society, and how should it contribute through individual or collective action, or both? This afternoon, I would suggest that our approach to faith in society, to the role of faith bodies in providing services, most notably in this context, education and health, is a product of a unique historical context and a philosophical tradition born out of that context. Our approach to faith bodies acting in society tells us something core about our society. But we run the risk that if we do not know our own tradition sufficiently well and the particular context that give birth to that tradition, then we might import a model which we think is similar or feasible but is not a product of our particular cultural or historical context or tradition. That, in my view, could lead to a rupture in the relationship between government and community, of which the faith dimension is a central element. In the face of complexity or challenge, we cannot abandon all too easily that which has served us well in recent centuries, and which we have arrived at in some of our societies after decades or indeed centuries of painful and turbulent efforts for inclusion. So what role for faith in our changing society and in the public square? It all depends on how governments see itself concerning broader society. If a government adopts a pluralist approach, as set out above, and has been the case in recent decades in Australia, then faith-based initiatives can thrive. However, if government sees itself as going down a more absolutist public provision of services to the detriment of society, then it is unlikely that government-funded faith initiatives will survive in their current form. And while that would be a regret due to the loss of government-funded initiatives, it would be an even greater loss to society because of what it would signify, because society would lose some of its most core and basic freedoms. Ultimately, freedom would be impinged, societal and personal. A state pays, so state rules approach could lead to totalitarianism and upset the inherent equilibrium in a society which all democratic nations should strive for. The purpose of government is to provide the opportunity for a good life for its citizens, not to define such a life for all citizens or extract resources from those citizens without representation and adequate checks and balances, nor to impose uniform beliefs on a population. While our governments can impose reasonable restrictions on the use of public funds, they shouldn't use the threat of deprivation of public funds either as a matter of outright strangulation of unfashionable beliefs and groups, or to favour some parts of the plurality over others, which would be unfair. That, ladies and gentlemen, would destroy over time associations and communities that do not support the government in every way. Governments should encourage what de Tocqueville called the mediating associations between people and the state and carve out room for a good and virtuous life. The risk, as highlighted by the philosopher Alistair MacIntyre, is that the modern secular nation sees itself in competition with such communities and associations, and as its resources grow, it will seek to wipe them out. So ultimately, unless very careful, secular nations with absolutist tendencies can weaken, even destroy democracy, which requires difference to function and to renew itself through constant questioning, critique, and reflection. So how do we avoid such a situation arising, where governments in the Western democratic tradition become illiberal? What role for faith? How do we not only ensure the survival of faith initiatives in society, but the inherent freedoms that go along with them? We do so, ladies and gentlemen, by engaging and responding coherently to arguments which question the role of faith in society. And we do not just do so to protect vested interest if it exists, but to do a broader service to the societies in which we live, to ensure they remain open, inclusive, and rooted in their core values, and always open and alive to critique. The role of faith in society today is to help to ensure a vibrant pluralist space in which faith-based institutions can thrive. For example, we must retain conviction about the offer of an education system inspired and built on a Catholic intellectual tradition, which forms the whole and not just a part. We must retain a confidence in the offer of an extensive network of Catholic healthcare, which places a value on human life and dignity throughout the human journey. We must remain proud of that purpose and contribution to society and not apologise for such a conviction. We must remain vigilant on the need to constantly integrate the Catholic ethos within our institutions with the prevailing necessary professional philosophy so that all will be reminded of the broader goals of faith and the need for distinctiveness. Retaining that integration requires constant attention. Getting the balance right all the time will not always be easy, especially with pressures from within a professional culture that rightly demands ever more inputs and data to be able to measure impact and value for money. But the Catholic institution needs to be as attentive to its ethos and identity as it is to the essential professional metrics. Otherwise, it runs the risk of cutting itself off from its roots and hence its distinctive offer, or to borrow a Habermas phrase, of drying up. Ladies and gentlemen, to succeed in retaining a role for faith in the public square, we must set the arguments in its widest context and show that it is not just about protecting vested interest, important as that is to the life of the church and society, but it goes much broader than that and touches the very notion of freedom within our society, present and future. Within that context, faith groups should always be free to make a distinctive offering to the society, complementing others and without discrimination. Of course, to do that will prove challenging along the way. Complexity usually is. But engagement and participation are always preferable to isolation and marginalisation, both for governments and faith groups, provided one does not lose its independence or distinctiveness to the other. Ladies and gentlemen, when faced with a choice, even when it is hard, We should always believe that the opportunities to serve the greater good and society are much stronger than the challenges, and that even the challenges will help us to remain agile, to refresh our offer and provide the opportunity to reacquaint ourselves with our own rich intellectual tradition and history of why things are as they are now. We must never be complacent about our pluralism, and we must protect and promote it with intellectual rigour because of the wider freedoms it supports in society, and one of those central freedoms is the offer of religious freedom. That offer helps to keep our societies pluralist and open through providing an alternative paradigm, and one which is capable of giving deeper meaning in an ever faster and changing society. Ladies and gentlemen, such an offer is in all our interests, whether we profess a religious belief or not. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Francis. There was an enormous amount to think about there, so I'll leave the throw the questions to the audience, comments, questions, straight away.
Thank you very much. I apologise if you did mention this and I missed it, but I wonder if you could comment on the situation of the Orthodox Church and the government in Russia at the moment.
You didn't miss it. So all I could say to you, the situation with the Orthodox Church in Russia, or within what I would describe as the various Orthodox churches across Europe, there's a very particular relationship. It's not exclusive to the Orthodox. I think there's examples within Catholicism as well, where perhaps there often is a fusion of the national identity with a particular church. One could cite in the Catholic world perhaps a period in Canada's history with Quebec and the Catholic Church. Ireland might be another example. Poland might be an example. Croatia might be another example. But I think the structure of the Orthodox churches around the nation, whether it is in Ukraine, where it's a contested space with the various patriarchates that are in place there, and who looks to Moscow and who looks to Constantinople, is a complex point within ecumenism. I think there's a question for religion across the piece, and I always believe in answering question from one's own perspective. And I think the challenge for religion in times of conflict is to be prophetic first and foremost to one's own community. Before one looks out, one should look in. And while I won't say something specific about the current situation with the Russian Orthodox Church and the conflict in Ukraine, but I will answer it this way, and I'm not sidestepping the question. In fact, I would say I'm owning it. I recall in September 1979 when the late Pope John Paul II came on what was the first visit of a pope to Ireland. And they tried desperately for him to visit Northern Ireland, but the circumstances in Northern Ireland at that time would have proved extremely difficult for a pope to cross the border. It would not have had perhaps all the intentions that the pope would have wanted. So they decided to bring him as far as they could to the border, but inside the Archdiocese of Armagh, and to have an afternoon of prayer. And I remember that his opening comments in his sermon were not directed at the injustice that many of his flock would have experienced from the state, but it was a reflection offered to his own community. And it was the phrase, "I'm calling on the men of violence to, on my knees, to lay down their arms." Now, I think there is a prophetic call that stands the test of time, that's not caught up in a moment, and is not caught up in an emotion, and is not necessarily a popular view to one's followers. It's a leadership call. and how that message was received by some parts of the community at that time, one will never know. But people listened, they adhered, and I think it was one of those occasions where the seeds of the future peace process were sown. So that for me is the task of a religious leader, and it's the task of a church, is to speak truth to power. It's to stand on the basis of the Christian message in a way that one is not caught up with the emotion of the moment. Because in conflict, it is very easy to follow. It is much more difficult to lead. And I think if there's a proper separation between church and state, then the role of faith complements in a society in a very rich way. If it loses in that space, in that societal space, then it can be very threatening. So I would use the Irish example, if you forgive me, and I think you can tell what I'm saying in relation to the context you raise, but I'm not an expert in relation to Russia and the Orthodox Church. I have some views, some background on it, but not a huge amount, but I would use the Irish example. And in my own context, and in what, as a Catholic, I heard on that day as a 9-year-old, and which resonates and still resonates some decades later as a prophetic, truthful, brave voice, where the message stands the test of time rather than telling us as a population at that time what we might have emotionally liked to hear. I hope that gives you an indirect answer to your question.
Francis, thanks very much indeed for your paper. You noted that the French Enlightenment was essentially about freedom from religion, whereas in the United States and perhaps in UK and Australia also, freedom for religion. And I think you're quite right that if we look at the United States, that enabled a much more effective and flexible relationship between the American state and religious communities. I wonder if you'd like to comment, and bearing in mind that in terms of your previous answer, you as you said, you're speaking from within your own community, your own perspective, first of all. But I wonder if you'd like to comment on the United States, since it is so important geopolitically and culturally for all of us. How do you see the relationship between religion and the state, religion and public life in the United States, particularly in recent decades, where I think it's simply obvious to say that the situation has become much more difficult? Thank you.
Thank you very much. And a fascinating question that could in itself be an entirely separate address. It's always, I suppose, if the diplomat in me loves to analyse other countries and societies from the outside. I do it here in Australia. And you compare and you contrast. And after your second or third posting as a diplomat, you realise that your sending state is not the norm. So you end up in this sort of ether where you're just observing and assessing what you see. And what do I see in the United States at the moment? So religion, you look in the United States, and you know, just this week in an interview with the Financial Times yesterday, Hillary Clinton talked about, you know, there a real risk to democracy and the democratic culture. So I'm not making a politically partisan point here. I'm saying that what strikes you from the outside is the absence of a homogeneity, whether this is exclusive to the United States or whether the United States is a forerunner of what's going to happen in other societies. I'm seeing tensions of them and us. What I tried to do in one broadcast for the BBC in London in 2018, I talked about, in relation to the aftermath of Brexit, I talked about the Ulsterisation of British politics. And the editor said, no, you're not using that phrase on live radio. We're not as bad as that. And I said, you are. And I think, so there's something firstly at a societal level, whether it's within Western societies alone or whether it's more broader, whether it's fueled by social media or some things that we're just simply not alive to, but which future generations will look back and say, why did you not see this? But there is some sort of an upheaval going on where there is a lack of a cohesion even on fundamentals. Our societies seem to be becoming polarized. And I think Pope Francis is alive to this in the way that he's fostering integral human development. So it's around, before you start sort of warring on particular identities, what do you share as a humanity, as a core humanity, or as a political community? So looking at it from the outside, you know, what's holding the United States together? The presidency has become, you know, it's like as if the respect that was there for the office of the presidency in previous generations has now become polarized depending on who's in power. The Supreme Court has become an issue. Congress seems highly polarized. And there is a huge sort of tension into which religion is also there, with a polarization between religions, between those who do not profess a religion, those who do, and then indeed within religious traditions, various religious traditions themselves. Those are the facts when you look from the outside, the perceivable facts. What's causing it? I don't know. Whether it's an exception to the United States, or whether it's something we're going to find in other countries, whether it's a rise of populism. But there's something about which I read in Hillary Clinton's piece yesterday which struck a chord. She talked about a rush to the extremes, and that nobody's defending the center. So within political parties, and I could countenance the same with regards to Britain. I won't comment on Australia. Maybe the diplomat in me says it's best not to comment on Australia. I'll leave that to you. You're more expert. But if I look within the United States, you know, one of the issues, you have a rush to the more left element of the Democratic Party. And within the Republican Party, you can see exactly what's happening, sort of focused around Donald Trump. If you look within Britain, again, when I talk to parliamentarians within Britain, they say the centre, where it would have been your centre voter between Labour and the Conservative and your swing voter, now the strident voices of the more militant right and left are to the fore. Again, what's causing that, and where does faith and religion step into that? And I come back to something that I said in the speech is, you know, if you quote Habermas and then you quote Ratzinger, there's a real risk that the bonds of solidarity are drying up. What gives us our solidarity in society? What has held it together, especially in the West, especially in the continent of Europe? And why do we now see more strident, polemical, nationalist voices coming along who are being rewarded in the ballot box? I don't know. Am I fearful about it? Yes. But then again, I would quote Joseph Ratzinger. Are we descending into some sort of Hobbesian war of subjective rights, where all that matters is volume, all that matters is your subjectivism, and your subjectivism is not based upon any external truth or value, it's based upon volume in social media or others. And then what sort of community cohesion, what are we building or creating? And potentially we're sort of descending into a simply might is right approach. So what is the role for religion or faith in that? And I would broaden it out beyond the United States. I would say, again, as a Catholic, I think, and it's one of the things as we move into the Plenary Council I'm always mindful of, and I'm a member of the Plenary Council. For me, the universality, at a time where we seem to be building up borders in our world, membership of the Catholic Church, for me, is the most universal, diverse organisation I will ever be a part of. It crosses everything. And I think into that space, the papacy in particular is contributing and reminding us of something broader, certain values, certain standards. So I can't give you a definitive answer as to what's going on, but I can say that when I look at critiques, especially in recent years by Pope Emeritus Benedict and by Pope Francis, I think they're speaking very positively into that space and very conscious of the unifying nature of the papacy, so that faith groups, in particular the Catholic Church in this context, isn't sucked into a secular polarization where the paradigm of secular politics is dividing the body politic of the Church. And one can have different views on different issues, but at the end of the day, you know, bringing it back to the integral human development and the totality of the Church, you shouldn't be saying I'm a Republican Catholic or I'm a Democratic Catholic or any other type of qualification on that. It's universal. It's sufficient to say you're Catholic, and it's into that space that I think religion should be speaking. I apologize if that's not a comprehensive and thorough answer for you, but it's a difficult one to answer in a short time.
It's a specifically Catholic position that a lot of what Catholics want to put in the public square is about natural law rather than specifically about faith, from bioethics to rights to a minimum wage. There's a Sydney journal about that called Solidarity, the Journal of Catholic Social Thought and Secular Ethics. I think it's the only academic journal published by Notre Dame University, but I'm not sure about that. It did quite well, but it seems to have lost support, and the last issue was 2019. Do you think there's a chance of Notre Dame University being a little more active in this area?
So hopefully in the generic, yes. In the particular, I'm not aware of the circumstances, and I hope its last publication has not been linked to my arrival, but I don't know the specifics of it. But I would hope that we would be contributing into that space. I think it's a duty of universities with a Catholic identity to perhaps be highlighting and critiquing and complimenting. So hopefully, yes.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed your challenging address. And how would you rephrase this if you were addressing one of these sudden United States audience? Now, as an undergraduate in second year, I studied Soviet Union as a model of authoritarian governments and the United States as a model of liberal democratic model. And for all its flaws, we accepted the liberal democratic method of the United States. Now, increasingly, over the years, I've, from my point of view, what I have observed and noted is the moral hollowing in which even some extreme religious groups have taken sides and opposing everything that you've said today, inclusivity, culture wars, and everything that goes with it. So how and where do we move forward somewhere in the United States with what the challenges that you've thrown at us?
So let me answer you in two ways. The first thing is I wouldn't change a word. This isn't context specific. I wouldn't change a word of this. So what would I say to you describe people, say, in the southern part of the United States, but I think it's more broader than that. So I would say two things. I would say, firstly, where a political class finds solace in faith and builds in that area, where it can be quite loud in volume, can be quite strident, in my view, looking at history, it never ends well for the message of the Church or for a religion. So the Church or the faith group can be used for a period of time while it might suit temporal or political ends. That's why the distinction in a really healthy society where state and church are separate, it's not a sort of a French system. It's where there's a vibrant society of which the state is a part and which other associations, including the church, is a part, is really healthy. Where one is instrumentalized by the other, it doesn't end well. So if I was speaking to people of a Christian belief or people of any other belief, with Islam or Hinduism, I would be cautioning very strongly any notion that the state should become a vehicle for religious endeavors, because that doesn't end well for the religion. The second thing I would say to you is we're all a product of what we say, and I can give you a sort of an intellectual coherence on it, as I've tried to do this afternoon. But my view is always around wanting to keep quite a strong distance. So I'm always, perhaps on the basis of my past, very nervous around a state becoming, telling me too much what I want to hear. My first parish priest used to say to me as an altar boy, there's nothing like a good dose of persecution to keep a strong church. And from my home, from my little bedroom window, I see two fields. There's two fields separate me from what is a country church. And that country church was the first one to be rebuilt after the Reformation in 1760. It was built before the penal legislation started to collapse. So, you know, from the mid-1550s through to 1760, that was a church that went underground and survived and thrived. And so I'm probably at the end of the spectrum that says to you, I would much rather be outside critiquing than creating a culture that is dependent and popular for the moment. That would always leave me nervous. And I think if one sees the flourishing of the French Catholic Church in the 19th century and the religious orders following the French Revolution, we should always be cautious when the religious message is popular. And maybe that's defeating, but I think religion and faith has a critiquing, enriching, complementing function for the society, where it's absorbed by the society, it could be smothered, can be used and smothered.
American policy is being promoted right around the world as being the guiding light for democratic principles. Now, there's a lot of followers right around the world, but as they observe the moral hollowing, as for want of a better word, and they see the decline in the democratic principles and behaviors by its different parts, is a very sorry model. So those that look up to the United States, how long can they continue to rely on American foreign policy as a beacon of hope and promotion of those democratic principles for which it stood for a long period of time?
But I would respond to that. Again, we're a historical society, so there's always, you know, there is always a need for renewal. So if you go back to the argument by Toynbee and, the name's escaping me for the moment, but there's an interwar debate which touches on the very question you're talking about. And Arnold Toynbee, and the name is escaping me, it'll come back to me when we're having a cup of tea. But Toynbee, the argument, the critique went, look, Western civilization has had its rise, has had its dominance, it's now on the decline. Okay? And he chronicles, you know, how many civilizations the world has known. I can't remember whether he cited 21 or 22. And he said Western civilization is no different. And Toynbee's critique was actually the West is different because, firstly, of its longevity, and secondly, for the role that Christianity plays, because Christianity acts as the mustard seed offering the renewal. You can only renew something when you reach a crisis. And you do not have, you know, you do not have eternal, you know, enthusiasm or vigor in a country. And you also look, you know, at, if you were to look, for example, at the success that Germany has had since the Second World War and how the United States built that up and the role of Germany in the European Union, etc., etc. So there is an opportunity for renewal. Sometimes crisis precipitates the call for renewal and a focus, and it stops us being complacent. Every society is at the risk of complacency. And I think you know, when we step into that sort of Toynbee-esque, and this is what Benedict, as Joseph Ratzinger was talking about when he talks about the creative minority, it's not his idea, it's actually Toynbee, and he footnotes Toynbee. People have brought that into the church to suggest that the creative minority means you go out into the desert and you sit out there. It's not. Actually, the creative minority is acting as a renewal, it's acting as the mustard seed right in the heart of society. And that maybe is what some of our Western democracies currently need, so that we're not seduced by the loud, polemical, nationalist voices that are pulling us towards parochialism and a sort of a demonization of the other on the basis of difference. So I think it could be and can be a renewal and a point of renewal and a point of attraction now and into the future. But that renewal process is probably what we're talking about.
I'm interested in exploring more this relationship between church leadership and political leadership as we negotiate this somewhat fragile world of faith in the public square. In the late 1980s, Cardinal Jaime Sin from Manila visited Sydney, and I had the job one day of taking him around the media from early morning to late night. And he had a common mantra, because he said the same thing at every interview, that if the church marries a political party, she runs the risk of becoming a widow at the next election. And that went down well. And I see some issues in the United States, episcopacy and a link that's very party-focused. But my question from the Australian context is this. I wonder if there's a naivety among some church leadership who have an expectation that the political leadership will deliver on certain questions without much understanding of the limits within which political leadership has to work in the compromises of a political party, of factions, in the compromises of a minority government situation and the like. So I was extremely disturbed a few weeks ago when I saw the Catholic Weekly editorialise an extraordinary attack on both Premier and Leader of the Opposition, both of whom are known to be men of substantial support for the Catholic position, the risk being that when it comes to the next question, that delicate relationship of mutual respect can be put at risk. And I wonder if you have any thoughts, not on the specific question, I don't want to put you on the spot about whether my example is a good one or not, but in general, how do we educate the episcopal leadership to a better understanding of political reality?
Thank you, Father Brian, for that question. And again, I think you're getting themes here for next year and beyond, as to invite different speakers back to address it. Let me respond to you, because I think this response, I think it's generically applied across much of the Western world. And I'm genuinely torn on this. I do not know the answer to this question, but I'll tell you what I see. There is a risk. I watched it on the British context perhaps more, but with a sort of a Northern Irish lens. And there is a risk, I think, in twofold. When do you, and here's the judgment, when do you be pragmatic and when do you be prophetic? If you're too pragmatic, a political cause or a political party could take you for granted. You could be seduced. So political backroom could always say, it's okay, that they'll take that, that you don't have to worry. If you're always operating in the prophetic, it means it's very difficult to navigate when you're going to become pragmatic. But the biggest risk that I see for, and I would say not just the episcopate, but I think those in positions of authority in the church, is that we're seduced into a false assumption that tradition or history means that we are guaranteed X, Y, or Z. So we become lazy about having to renew the argument or the battle or mobilise a community around, say, state funding for Catholic education. I think in a number of countries there's a real risk that we have become a tad intellectually lazy about the broader arguments about why something is as it is. And when we ask or when we are confronted with some of the fundamental questions, our responses can simply, can simply sort of rely on an argument that, well, we've had it for 40 years, we've had it for 50 years. And that's a very weak edifice on which to be asking for public funding. So part of what I'm arguing here is that simply going in and saying, we've always had public subsidy, we won this right in year dot, it's a tradition. As a faith community perhaps weakens in composition, as the society secularizes, as the voice reduces, if you're simply at the mercy of the volume of a constituency, at a certain stage a political party or those in government will begin to take note. They'll follow the size, the volume, unless you've put in the underpinning arguments around a rich plurality and why things are as they are. So I think there's a side to your question which is around how we deal with the areas of huge engagement around health and education and how we retain the vibrancy of that offer, but we simply should never be seduced that it's a historical fact, therefore it should always be. It needs to be argued for each generation and promoted and understood and appreciated, and we have to argue it with slightly different language than we might have argued 4 or 5 decades ago. But the other dimension to your question is the challenge for everyone in a form of religious leadership, going right up to the Pope. And that is around judging when to be prophetic and when to be pragmatic. And I used to see it played out quite differently between the Scottish Catholic Church and the English Catholic Church. And the English Catholic Church, their leaders would always favour, understatement and, a model that perhaps had worked in the past, permanent secretaries and civil servants, but understated. Scottish Catholic Church didn't tend to be more Irish. And there were two religious leaders, one in Scotland, one in England, and the issue of the Act of Settlement came up. And the Scottish leader said, this is absolutely terrible, Catholics being discriminated and, marginalised by this piece of legislation, and it needs to change. And then the BBC asked the English cardinal, and he said, yes, it is disgraceful. He said, the royal family said, I don't know how they can tolerate this level of discrimination against themselves about who they can marry and can't marry. So there's one contentious historical issue, but approached by two different Catholic religious leaders, one seeing it as a slight upon the Catholic community, the other framing it as a slight upon the infringement of the human rights of the royal family. I think it does come down to us asking ourselves at all stages as believers, when is the time to be prophetic? When is the time to perhaps be pragmatic? And that's helped sometimes by placing yourself in the shoes of your opposite number, a politician or a minister, whether they're Catholic or not. And when you walk in their shoes, you can ask yourself the reasonable question, what would I do? And then I think that gives you a degree of humility that your options perhaps are not as black and white as it might appear initially to be when you're sitting in the comfort of your own position. But that's somebody that observed it more from the back room of the British side rather than the Australian side.
I think, to be fair to Professor Campbell, we might pause for a cup of tea at this point. He's given us an extraordinary reminder of the tension between principle and pragmatism. He's brought to my mind a couple of poets one of them is from your own country, when Yeats talked about when the centre cannot hold. I've forgotten which poem it comes from now, but it's very, very important. And of course, Henry Newbolt's when Horatio defended the bridge, and those behind cried forward, and those in front cried back. So it's very salutary to be reminded that life is not a settled process, and it's a matter of negotiation. Never succeed. Never relinquish principle, but never sneer at pragmatism as well. So thank you very much indeed. We might have you back too, because I think there are more to be there. Thank you very much.
We've been listening to the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Notre Dame, Australia, Professor Francis Campbell, address The Place for Faith in the Public Square. The Q&A which followed was moderated by Dr. John Carmody, President of the Australian Catholic Historical Society. It all took place on Sunday the 19th of June 2022 in the crypt of St. Patrick's, Churchill, Sydney, Australia. Before we go, here's Sister Helen Simpson, the ACHS chaplain, with the prayer which she led to open the meeting and which could be our prayer to go.
In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, Amen. Amen. Give us, O Lord, a pure heart that we may see you, a humble heart that we may hear you, a heart of love that we may serve you, a heart of faith that we may love you, and keep us always true to you. Amen.
The ACHS podcast is produced by me, John Kenny. There'll be another history talk on the afternoon of Sunday, the 17th of July, 2022, when Dr. Darren Mitchell, formerly Director of the New South Wales ANZAC Memorial Sydney, will speak about ANZAC Day Sydney 1916, an origin story, how the Anglican Church laid the foundations for Australia's National Day of Commemoration. We look forward to having you along for that talk. Until then, please stay well.